Well, good afternoon, everyone. I appreciate all the special music that we had today. You know, special music and just music in general has always been a part of our worship service, and I think it's wonderful that we have the extra today, and really I'd like to see us do it a little more often in our regular services even. I think it's nice to worship God with song and musical ability. The last day of Unleavened Bread services will be at 10:30 and 3. And I had emailed out the directions to everyone how to get there. I will redo that this week so that you don't have to go back searching through all your emails to look for them. But I'll send that out again. And anyone who doesn't have email who needs it can get a hold of me, or we'll put the list out there or the directions out there on the table today. You can write them down. I hope you all had a really nice night to be remembered, night to be observed last night. We were here at the hall and we had 64, and it was very nice. The food was delicious, the company was great, and we just enjoyed it thoroughly. And I hope that wherever you were, if you weren't here with us, that you also had a very memorable night, and one that was a very good one. We do have leftovers. We did not ask anyone to bring snacks today, but we are going to set out what we have left as snacks. Of course, there's not, you know, nobody's going to get a meal out of this today, but you will be able to at least have snacks and enjoy some of what we had here last night. So after services, we will have that. You have that to look forward to. One thing that I think that we're losing as a nation is our history. And we're doing it almost purposefully. As we like to look back at events that shaped our nation, things that made us who we are, and we like to look at them through the lens of today's political correctness. And rather than recognize the things that were done, that God has done for this nation, we look back shamefully, or at least that's what we're taught. History is history. And if it's our history and there's shameful things in there, then we're to learn from it and grow and move forward. Not ignore it, not act like it didn't happen. But I do feel like we are not teaching history as we should today. That being said, today I would like to look back at our history. For many of us, this is physical history, our lineage that goes all the way back. For others of us, if you don't fall into that category, it's at least our spiritual history. I want to look today at Israel in the land of Egypt. We have not covered this in quite a while, not gone through the story. And especially some of our young people may not know the history of what happened with Israel when they were in the land of Egypt. So I'd like to go through that today and bring to light the history that took place. I want to look at how God freed the Israelites from the Egyptians. But before I do that, I want to go back even further than that and talk about how they came to be enslaved. Some of our younger people especially, or our newer people, may have heard the story and watched the Ten Commandments and never even gave it a second thought. Well, how did they even get there to start with? That goes back to the story of Joseph. Joseph was sold by his brothers into slavery. He ended up in Egypt, and he brought his family there during the famine. There was a great famine at that time, and Joseph, because of him being in Egypt and being in the position that he was put in, was able to save many people. And he even made the comment to his brothers, what you meant to be evil and harmful, God meant for good. He was able to see that God used what they did against him to help him save many people, especially his family. So as time went on, Joseph died. A new Pharaoh came into power. This Pharaoh did not know Joseph and his family, and he became threatened by them. Because the people of Israel started to grow, they were multiplying. The new Pharaoh of Egypt was threatened by them. He was very uncomfortable with so many of them being in his country. So he enslaved them and started making life very harsh for them. We read about this in Exodus 1, verse 6. Exodus 1, verse 6 says, "And Joseph died, all of his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, 'Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And it happen in the event of a war that they also join our enemies and fight against us and go up out of the land.'" So he was afraid that if they ever became under attack, that the Israelites would join up with the attackers and overthrow them from within. Verse 13 says, "So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor." It was hard work. They wanted to keep them busy. They wanted to stop them from having any thoughts of joining together and rising up against them. So they made their work very hard. And yet they continued to grow. Verse 16, we see he said to the midwives, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and you see them on birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them." Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mightily. They continued to grow. Verse 22, "So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, 'Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive.'" So he gave his own people the authority. If they saw a male child of the Israelites, they were to throw him into the river. They were to kill them. It's interesting, the first plague that came when God turned the river to blood. I read somewhere that it's almost like God said, "You tried to fill this river with blood. You want blood out of this river? Here's your blood." We'll get to that first plague in a little bit, but just you can imagine the atmosphere, the fear that would be among the Israelites when everyone amongst them, if they see them with a small baby boy, was able to take it from them and go and kill it. Let's turn back to Genesis 22, verse 16 for a moment. Going back to the story of Abraham as he was asked to sacrifice his son. Genesis 22, verse 16 and 18. "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." In spite of the hardships placed upon them by their captors, in spite of everything that was being done to stop them from growing as a people, the people of Israel became a nation while they were enslaved. That was a result of this blessing that God had placed on them, that they were going to become a great people. So we see that even while they are in slavery and they're having their babies killed, God still followed through on this promise, and they continued to grow, and they became a great nation. Back to Exodus 2, starting in verse 1, we read about Moses being born. And Moses was born at this time when the male children were to be killed. Exodus 2, starting in verse 1. And a man of the house of Levi went and took as a wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the river, and her maidens walking along the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" So Moses' sister was right there. And when she saw, as soon as she saw him take the baby up, she offered, "I can find someone to nurse that baby for you if you'd like." Of course, it turned out to be Moses' mother. It was a direct blessing from God that she was able to raise Moses up to a certain age when the Pharaoh's daughter would take over. Verse 9. So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I have drawn him out of the water." So he's being raised by the Pharaoh's daughter. Verse 11, now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" Moses couldn't understand this. He's like, "We should be one. Don't you guys understand? Why are you fighting each other?" Verse 14, then he said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. So here's this great hope for the nation of Israel. And we aren't really told that much about him, are we? He was born. He was raised by Pharaoh's daughter. He killed a man. And then he fled. When we turn back to Acts chapter 7, we can get a little bit more insight into Moses' life as a child and what it was like as he grew up. Acts 7, verse 17. Actually, we'll drop down to verse 20. Verse 17 through 19 talks about the new Pharaoh coming to power that didn't know Joseph and dealing treacherously with the nation. But verse 20, it says, "At this time Moses was born and was well pleasing to God. He was brought up in his father's house for 3 months." So we see his mother got to raise him for 3 months. "But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. Now when he was 40 years old, it came to his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed," and this is an important thing to take into mind here, "he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. And the next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting and tried to reconcile them, saying, Men, why are you brethren? Why are you fighting one another? But he who did his neighbor wrong pushed them away, saying, Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday? Then at this saying, Moses fled. You see, Moses had a plan. Moses wanted to free the Israelites. And he just assumed that they would all understand that. That they would fall in line and let him be that person that would lead them out. He was in a position where he probably could have at some point freed them. But God had a different plan. God was going to lead them out. But he wasn't ready yet. Or rather, Moses wasn't ready yet. Because had this been done through Moses being very high up, it appears maybe Moses was even being trained to be a Pharaoh someday. If not, at least very high up in the government of Egypt. At least to a point where he could have freed the slaves. But what glory would that have been to God? What lessons could have been learned if Moses just went up through the ranks and got to the point where he could free the slaves? How would that show God's might? So God had a different plan. And once Moses left Egypt, he probably never gave it another thought. He probably never at least planned on returning there. Certainly not to go back and free the slaves, right? After all, they were ungrateful. They made this thing known that he had killed an Egyptian. They got him in trouble when he was trying to save them. And he had to flee. But God came to Moses in the form of a burning bush and told him it was time. God heard the pleas from the Israelites, and he was going to send Moses back to free them. Exodus 3 and verse 10. God says, Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Isn't that interesting that Moses' whole thought had changed? Who am I that I should go before Pharaoh? In a way, the Pharaoh was his family. He grew up in that family. Just the very fact that he's able to go back and come before Pharaoh to talk to him shows that he was somebody that had that access. So when Moses says, Who am I that I should go? Which shows that Moses had been humbled very greatly. And now he was going to be used to do something that at one time he thought was his lot in life. He was going to do it. And he was willing to do it. But now he didn't want to do this. He had no desire to go back to Egypt. He had no desire to go talk to the Pharaoh. But God told him, This is your job. This is what you're going to do. As I said, no one else could go before Pharaoh and speak to him in the way that Moses did, aggravate him the way that he did. No one else had that access. Moses obviously was the one that was to go there. Exodus 4 and verse 13, though, but Moses, he says, O my Lord, please, send by the hand of whomever else you may send. You know, I don't know, there's a billion people on this earth, God, pick one of them. Don't send me. Moses did not want to go back and be the deliverer. And God said, Okay, all right, I'll send somebody else. I'll send your brother Aaron, but you're going to go with him. He was not getting out of the job. Now, probably as Moses had expected, his first meeting with the Pharaoh didn't go over very well. Turn back to Exodus chapter 5 and verse 1. We read of this first meeting between Moses, Aaron, and Pharaoh. Exodus 5 verse 1, afterward Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is this Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go?" As we're going to see, Pharaoh had a lot to learn. Not willingly, but he was about to learn who this Lord was that Moses was talking about. He says, "I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." So they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." Then the king of Egypt said to them, verse 4, "Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor." And Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor." So the same day Pharaoh commanded that the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather the straw for themselves, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry out, saying, 'Let us go sacrifice to our God. Let more work be laid on the men that they may labor in it, and let them not regard these false words.'" So the stage is set. This is how this is going to go. The Pharaoh is going to fight this all the way. He does not want to let them go. He's certainly not going to listen to Moses. So he increases their work. He says, obviously they have too much free time on their hands if they have time to sit around and think about this. Let's increase their work. Let's make them go out and get the straw they need to make the bricks. And don't cut down how many bricks they need to make per day. So their task became much more hard. I don't suppose Moses and Aaron were very welcomed in any camp at that point. But God told them not to lose heart, that this was all part of their plan. He told them, the Pharaoh's going to harden his heart, and I'm going to bring stuff upon him. And we won't go through all the different conversations between Pharaoh and Moses and Aaron, but if you are so inclined to read through it, it's very interesting how many times the Pharaoh's heart was softened, and then it would harden again, and then it would soften, and then sometimes it would soften just to make something end, and then he had no intention of doing what it is he said he was going to do. But God says this is all part of the plan. It's not going to be an easy task. Exodus 7, verse 1 through 5. Exodus 7, verse 1 through 5. "The Lord said to Moses, 'See, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of this land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on everything and bring out the children of Israel from among them.'" God told Moses he was going to do three things through this process. He was going to bring the Israelites out of Egypt. He was going to do it by great judgments. And he was going to do it in a way that the Egyptians would know that he is the Lord, the one true God. I'm not going to go into the description of all their gods, but just let it be known that the Egyptians had many, many gods. And if you have the latest Beyond Today magazine, there's an article in here that talks about the judgment on Egypt's gods. It talks about the plagues that came upon the land and the specific gods that were being targeted by these plagues. You see, what God wanted to do was to break Israel's dependence on foreign gods, because Egypt had so many gods for so many things. And of course, God has a plan when he does anything. These weren't just random plagues that God sent on Egypt. These were affronts to the Egyptian gods. As I said earlier, had Moses just been able to free the slaves, they would have never seen God fight against the Egyptian gods. And they would have taken some of these customs with them. And in fact, they did take some of these customs with them as they left, right? They got in trouble a lot for making false idols. I was thinking as I was going through this, I guess in a way, I'm kind of surprised that they made a golden calf when you think about the 10th plague. I'm surprised they didn't make a golden lamb. But nonetheless, they reverted back to Egyptian gods. They built the golden calf, and Aaron himself said, "Here's the God that brought you out of the land of Egypt." And they paid a great price for that. But part of what God was doing here was fighting against the gods of the Egyptians so that they would know their God was the one true God. So the Egyptians worshipped many gods. One thing we don't know about these plagues is how long they lasted. We only are told of three of them. The first one lasted 7 days. The ninth one lasted 3 days. And the tenth one lasted one night. We don't know how long the plagues were upon the land. And we don't know the amount of time between plagues. Some Bible scholars figure that it's somewhere around 5 to 6 months all this took place. But that's just speculation, so I'm not saying that's to be the case. But, you know, I've never really, I guess, thought about that until I started going through this. How long of a process was this? How long did God deal with them? So let's look at these plagues and see what God did to defeat one of the most powerful nations of its day. And let's keep in mind also, these are specific plagues from God. You can go online or you can find books, magazine articles, and they will explain to you how all these plagues happen. You see, there was this great volcano, and that made the river red, and that made the frogs come out. And they try to explain, you know, scientifically how God could have done this. But they can't explain how God says it will start now. Okay, it'll end now. It'll be here, but not there. These were deliberate plagues sent by God. Not natural occurrences that God just happened to work with, but deliberate plagues sent by God. So let's keep that in mind. This was God fighting the Egyptians. God said he would deliver his people through great judgments, and that's exactly what he did. Let's turn back now to Exodus chapter 7, verse 14, and we'll look at we'll start going through these plagues that God sent upon the nation of Egypt. Exodus chapter 7. Starting in verse 14, the first plague, which is water being turned to blood. Verse 14, so the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hard and he refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning when he goes out to the water, and you shall stand by the river's bank to meet him. And the rod which was turned to a serpent you shall take in your hand. And you shall say to him, the Lord God of the Hebrews has sent me to you, saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But indeed, until now, you would not hear. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the waters which are in the river with the rod that is in my hand, and they shall be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians will loathe to drink the water of the river. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, Take your rod and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the streams, over the rivers, over the ponds, and over all their pools of water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in buckets of wood and pitchers of stone. Again, if this were caused by some natural phenomenon, like a volcano or something, how would you account for the ponds and the puddles of water, it says? And not only that, but it seems like it was water that had already been drawn out of the river previously and was stored in clay pots or buckets. Everything turned to blood, every source of water that they had. Verse 20, and Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded. So he lifted up the rod, struck the waters that were in the river in the sight of Pharaoh, and in the sight of his servants, and all the waters that were in the river turned to blood. The fish that were in the river died, the river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river. So there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. Then the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments, and Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them as the Lord had said. So somehow the magicians that were on Pharaoh's court were able to perform a similar feat. They were able to take water and turn it into blood. Now, if I was Pharaoh at that moment, I would say, you're going the wrong way. Turn the blood back to water. I don't need anybody else turning water into blood. But of course, this was some sort of trickery that they had. But they were able to do it in a way that Pharaoh thought, no, it's no big deal. My magicians can do that. You realize, at this point, with this one plague, God could have destroyed the entire nation. That could have been the end right there, had he just not brought back the water for them to drink. But he was not done yet. He was still working with his people. He was still teaching lessons. The second plague, we read about in Exodus 8, verse 1 through 4. It's a plague of frogs. Exodus 8, verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite all your territory with frogs. So the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into your house and into your bedroom, on your bed, in the houses of your servants, on your people, into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. And the frogs shall come upon you, on your people, and all your servants. Again, you can read about this in the latest Beyond Today magazine, but the frog was a deity to the Egyptians, and a very important one to them, because it lived in two worlds. It was amphibious. It lived in water and it lived on land, so they had even more respect for this. So much so that accidentally stepping on a frog and killing it could be a death sentence for you. Frogs meant a lot to the Egyptians. But I bet they got sick of them really fast. I bet all of a sudden they started thinking, this is not something that we should be worshiping. Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron back and it's like, all right, we've had enough. Please take the frogs away. And God said that he would, and they left. Exodus 8, let's drop down to verse 12. Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried out to the Lord concerning the frogs which he had brought against Pharaoh. So the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out in the houses of the courtyards and of the fields. He didn't send them back. He just let them all die. Right where they were, in the fields, in their houses. Verse 14, so they gathered them together in heaps, and the land stank. Could you imagine all that rotting flesh? I mean, you think of a little tiny frog, isn't that much? But when you've got millions of them, and you've got heaps of them, and of course, at that time, they were limited on how quickly they could gather them up and how far they can move them. It says the whole land stank rotting flesh, decaying frogs. That was their God. That was one of their gods. And they had to just be reminded of that every day, going out and smelling that. But Pharaoh was not convinced at this point. After all, now he'd had relief, except for the stench in the air, which I'm sure he didn't allow them to put heaps of dead frogs around where he lived. But he had changed his mind once again and was not going to let the people go. So the third plague came upon them. That was lice. Read about this in Exodus 8, chapter 16 through 19. So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land, that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so, for Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and struck the dust of the earth, and it became lice on man and beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. Now the magicians so worked with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there were lice on man and beast. So at this point now, they've come to something that the magicians couldn't replicate. They couldn't all of a sudden make lice appear. Why they would want to, I'm not sure. But this is one they could not do. Verse 19, then the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, just as the Lord had said. So up until this time, the magicians could in some way replicate what was being done. But all of a sudden, they couldn't. And they told Pharaoh, this is of God. This is not something that could just be done. But Pharaoh hardened his heart and would not let them go. So a fourth plague came upon them. Exodus 8, verse 20 through 24. Exodus 8, verse 20. And the Lord said to Moses, rise early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water. I like how God had him do this every time. He's like, go stand, make sure Pharaoh sees you. When he's looking, do this. So he knows where it's coming from. He knows it's not just all of a sudden, oh, there's things happening here. He knew where it was coming from. So he said, stand before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water, then say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. Verse 21, or else if you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies on you and on your servants and on your people and in your houses. The houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground on which they stand. And in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. I will make a difference between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall be. And the Lord did so. And the swarms of flies came into the house of Pharaoh, into his servants' houses, and into all the land of Egypt was corrupted because of the swarms of flies. Now, your Bible may have the word of flies italicized or a different color. That's because the words of flies was added. It's not what the original text said. The original text just said swarms. But the idea is it was some sort of buzzing, flying insects. In a likely scenario, based on what God has done up to this time and how he is attacking the gods of the Egyptians, these were most likely dung beetles. You see, the Egyptians thought very highly of the dung beetle because they just appeared out of nowhere. Well, out of dung. Not realizing that eggs were laid in there and that's where they lived and grew. But it's very likely that these could have been just swarms of dung beetles, which are very destructive. They have the little pincers on them. I don't know if they bite or not, but they do. They are very destructive and would be very annoying. Have you ever had one flying insect fly around you? Drives you crazy, especially a gnat, right? You're just like, where is it? You can't see it. You can't swat at it. You can't. But swarms of them. As we've seen before, God didn't do any of these plagues half-heartedly. These people were being covered with these things. It would have been constantly flying around them. You would have had to have eaten them because you couldn't get them out of your food, right? They're just everywhere. Once again, God was pointing out, your God is powerless. And, of course, their gods remained silent, did nothing to help the people at that time because they're not really gods. They were figments of their imagination that they worshipped. Once again, Pharaoh refused to let the people go. Next came the fifth plague, diseases on livestock. The interesting thing about this last plague, the swarms, from this point forward, God made a distinction, and none of the rest of these plagues bothered the Israelites. That could not naturally happen. This was God. He said, I'm going to make a difference between your people and my people. You're going to see I'm going to protect my people. So they didn't have to deal with the swarms, and I'm sure they were very glad for that. The fifth plague also they were protected from. Exodus 9, verse 1. Exodus 9, verse 1, the diseases on the livestock. Then the Lord said to Moses, go into Pharaoh and tell him, thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let them go and still hold them, behold, the hand of the Lord will be on your cattle in the field, on the horses, on the donkeys, on the camels, on the oxen, and on the sheep, a very severe pestilence. And the Lord will make a difference between the livestock of the Israelites and the livestock of Egypt. So nothing shall die of all that belongs to the children of Israel. Then the Lord appointed a set time, saying, tomorrow the Lord will do this thing in the land. So the Lord did this thing on the next day, and all the livestock of Egypt died. But of the livestock of the children of Israel, not one died. Then Pharaoh sent, and indeed not one of the livestock of the Israelites was dead. But the heart of Pharaoh became hard, and he did not let the people go. So at this point, he wanted to, is that really true? Did God really protect them from what I'm looking at out here in the field? So he sent people to go check on the Israelites' livestock, and they were fine. God had protected them. It seems this affected animals that were in the fields, as of course Pharaoh still had an army and chariots and things like that. But all the animals that were in the field, which would have been most of the animals, because not everyone has enough storage to bring all their animals in. But the animals that were in the field were affected by this. So this would have affected their food, transportation, military capacity. So much would have been their economy of the Egyptians are being destroyed a little bit at a time. God's working on them. But as we read, Pharaoh became hard, did not let the people go. Still not convinced yet. So the sixth plague comes, and that's boils. I've never had a boil, but just the word boil sounds painful. Exodus 9, verse 8 through 11. So the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, take for yourselves handful of ashes from a furnace and let Moses scatter it towards the heavens in the sight of Pharaoh. And it will become a fine dust in all the land of Egypt, and it will cause boils that will break out as sores on man and beast throughout the land of Egypt. Then they took the ashes from the furnace and stood before Pharaoh and Moses and scattered them towards heaven, and they caused boils that break out in sores on man and beast. And the magicians could not even stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils were on the magicians and all of the Egyptians. The article in the Beyond Today magazine says that these furnaces may have been used for sacrifice, child sacrifices. And what they would do is they would take these ashes out and they would throw it into the air, and if the ashes landed on you, it was a blessing. It's interesting how God did the same motion, but instead of a blessing, it was a curse. They took the same ashes out of that furnace and threw it into the air, and it caused painful boils on all the Egyptians. And again, I'm sure the Israelites at this point were starting to realize that God was fighting for them as they did not have to deal with this and could see surely all their neighbors and all the Egyptians fighting these horrible boils. But that didn't work either. So now we come to the seventh plague, hail. Read about this in Exodus 9, verse 18 through 26. Starting in verse 18, God says, "Behold, tomorrow about this time I will cause very heavy hail to rain down, such as not been since in Egypt since its finding until now. Therefore, send now and gather your livestock and all that you have in the field, for the hail shall come down on every man and every animal which is found in the field and is not brought home. They shall die." God gave him a warning. He's like, look, here's what I'm going to do. You've never seen hail like this before, and it's going to kill everything in the field. I'm giving you a chance. Bring in your livestock. Bring in your servants. Verse 20 says, "He who feared the word of the Lord among the servants of the Pharaoh made his servants and his livestock flee to the houses. But he who did not regard the word of the Lord left his servants and his livestock in the field." It's hard to believe at this point there were still some who thought this isn't going to happen. But it is interesting to note that there were some who starting to crack and said, "I'm bringing in my livestock and my servants, because this dreadful thing is about to happen." Verse 23, "Moses stretched out his rod toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire darted to the ground. And the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. So there was hail and fire mingled with the hail, so very heavy that there was none like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. And the hail struck throughout the whole land of Egypt, all that was in the field, both man and beast, and the hail struck every herb of the field and broke every tree of the field. Only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, was there no hail." This part of the world usually only gets about 2 inches of rain every year. So when God says that this was a hail like there had never been since the beginning of this nation, you can believe that. They didn't have hail. They barely had rain. But God sent this to warn them. And again, some of Pharaoh's servants heeded that warning and brought in their stuff and were able to avoid being affected by this, except for their crops, of course. They couldn't bring in their crops, their trees, things like that. The eighth plague, locusts, Exodus 10, verse 12. Exodus 10, verse 12, "The Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every herb of the land and all that the hail has left." So everything that got missed by the hail was about to get ravished by locusts. "Moses stretched out his rod over the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. And the locusts went up all over the land of Egypt, rested on the territory of Egypt. They were very severe. Previously, there had been no such locusts, nor shall there be such after them. For they covered the whole face of the earth, that the land was darkened, and they ate every herb of it, and the land and all the fruit of the trees, which the hail had left. So there remained nothing green on the trees, nor in the plants of the field throughout all the land of Egypt. There were so many that they darkened the land." That's, you couldn't even see land anymore. All you could see was locusts. We've had, of course, we have our year of the locusts around here ever so often, and you can hear them in the trees and stuff, but you don't see them as much as what is said here. They couldn't even see the land. Everything was so covered with it. This definitely was a plague from God. We go on down. We see the Pharaoh calls Moses in. He's like, "All right, I've had enough. Please ask God to take these away, and I'll let the people go. I'll do what you want." Verse 19, the Lord turned a very strong west wind that took the locusts away and blew them into the Red Sea. There remained not one locust in this territory of Egypt. It was a very thorough cleansing. God took them out. He took them all out, just as he brought them all in. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the children go. By now, there was very little left of the nation of Egypt. I'm sure the Egyptians are starting to want this to end. But Pharaoh had a very hard heart. I'm sure he's starting to come to grips with the fact that this has got to end, or we're going to end. But still, he had the hardness of heart and refused to let them go. Then came the ninth plague, darkness. Darkness. Sometimes when we think of darkness, you know, we have a lot of what they call light pollution. We don't really get a true darkness. But Exodus 10, verse 21 through 23, as we read about this, Exodus 10, starting in verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards heaven that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt. Darkness you could almost feel. It was just so heavy around you. Not a little glimmer of light anywhere. I don't know if I've heard stories of there's caves where you can go and when you get in there, they'll turn off the lights and you can do this and not even see your hand. That's what it was like for the Egyptians. They couldn't see anything. 3 days. Could you imagine? Just place yourself in your home. What would you do? How would you find your way to your bed? When would you know it was time to go to bed? How would you find your way to your kitchen, into your pantry? What are you pulling out? And me, I would be thinking, are there other plagues here too? Am I going to eat a fly? Or what exactly is it that I'm getting ready to put in my mouth? But such darkness, they could not see anything. Just darkness so heavy they could feel it. Verse 22, Moses stretched out his hand towards heaven, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did they rise from his place for 3 days, but all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. They didn't rise from their place for three. They weren't going to walk out. They weren't going to leave their property or their homes. I mean, if you don't really feel safe walking around inside your house, you walk outside, how are you going to ever find your way back? So they stayed in their homes for 3 days. This darkness would have been quite a challenge. But still, Pharaoh was not ready to let them go. So the tenth plague came, the death of the firstborn. We'll start reading about this in Exodus 11, verse 4. Exodus 11, verse 4, Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals. Then there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like before, nor ever shall be again. You can imagine a cry that would go out. Turn over to Exodus 12, starting in verse 1. Exodus 12, starting in verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be the beginning of months. This shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th, of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons. According to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses where they will eat it. So they had to take the blood from the lamb, put it on their doorposts and the lintel across their door. Let's drop on down to verse 12. God explains, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." Again, there was a difference made between the Israelites and the Egyptians. But this time, the Israelites had to do something. God wasn't just going to pass over them because they were Israelites. They had to put this blood on their doorpost. They had to put this sign up that said, "I know you are God, and I trust that you will pass over my house." So they did that. Drop down to verse 29, Exodus 12, "And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all of his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead." I mean, if you think about a firstborn, every family has firstborns. Some houses, it could have been two or three that died. Could have been a mother, a father, and a child. The firstborn, not including all pets and animals. But every house of the Egyptians had a death in it. Verse 31, "Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, 'Rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Lord of God as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds, as you have said, and be gone and bless me also.' And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste. For they said, 'We shall all be dead.'" The Egyptians are like, "Get out of here. I don't care what it takes. Just go, or we're all going to be dead." Verse 34, "So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their clothes on their shoulders. And the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in their sight of the Egyptians, so they granted them what they requested. And on their way out, they plundered the Egyptians." They took everything of value, and the Egyptians were glad to give it to them. "Whatever it takes, just take this and go. Get away from us." They knew it would do them no good if they were dead, and that's where they were all headed. And things continued. So they plundered the Egyptians. They were paid for all their years of slavery, all the time that they had put in. You know, a nation is defeated when you can plunder them. It's one thing to have someone surrender and say, "Okay, let's just stop fighting." But for them to say, "Here, take everything we've got of value," you have truly defeated them. The end result of what we see is God did exactly what he told Moses he was going to do. He brought the Israelites out of Egypt. He did it by great judgments. And he did it in a way that the Egyptians would know that he is the Lord, the one true God. And of course, this was a lesson that he was hoping that Israel would take with them as well, that they were being led out by the one true God. Continuing on in the story, Pharaoh's heart one more time was hardened, and he gave chase. He decided he was going to go get them, bring them all back. Once again, God interceded for them. Exodus 14, Pharaoh's army's pursuing them, and they've caught up to them, and they're at the Red Sea, and the sea's in front of them, and the army's behind them, and the people are starting to cry out to Moses, you know, was there not enough graves in Egypt? You brought us out here to die. They'd already lost faith in what God had done up to this point. There was a lot of not looking back at what had happened that takes place in the next few verses of this story. Verse 13, Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you see today, you shall see no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." Once again, he had to remind them, God's going to fight for you. Don't be afraid. Verse 15, and the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward." He said, "Don't. Why? Why are you crying? Just go." Of course, there was a river in front of them, right? And God's just saying, "Just go." God's probably thinking, how can you not know I'm going to make a way of escape for you? I've done it so many times. Do you not remember the last six plagues did not bother you? But we know the Israelites had a lot to learn. Apparently, Pharaoh and his army did as well, because as they pursued them, as God parted the Red Sea, and the Israelites went through on dry ground, no less, the Egyptians started to pursue them. And maybe they were getting a little bit too close for comfort, and God made the wheels fall off their chariots, and it slowed them down a little bit more. Now, at this point, if I were an Egyptian and the wheels fell off my chariot, and I saw all the other wheels fall off everybody else's chariot and realize we're being slowed down and realize what we had just gone through for so long, I like to think I would have turned around. I like to think I would have thought, I'm not going to fight this God anymore. But they didn't. It's like the person, the Roman soldier who came to arrest Christ and had his ear cut off. And Christ reaches up and heals him. At that point, if I was that soldier, I would like to think, I would have thought, I want no part of this. We're doing something wrong. But the army followed them into the Red Sea, and once the Israelites were safely through, God closed the Red Sea back up on the Egyptian army and destroyed them. He had defeated so much of Egypt, and now he defeated their army. When you think about everything that Egypt went through at this time, the economic destruction that came upon them, the loss of firstborns, the loss of their army, I truly believe it's only by God's will that there is a nation of Egypt today. How in the world did they ever survive that and still be a nation among us today? It has to be by God's will. There's many lessons that we can learn from this story. And I'm so glad that that's in here for us to read through and to rehearse. And as I said, I don't feel like we've gone through it in quite a while. So I felt it was important to bring this story out today. God did what seemed impossible at that time to free them from the most powerful nation that was there on the earth. There are lessons we can learn about who God is, what he was trying to teach his people, what he was trying to teach the Israelites. And I hope that we can go back and read through this and pick up on some of those lessons and take them with us. These are things that we rehearsed as we go through the night to be observed, Passover, and into the days of unleavened bread. How God freed Israel from captivity. Let's not forget God's done many miracles in our lives. God has freed every one of us from captivity. Let's not look to anything else other than God to appreciate where we are and what we have. Have a great Feast of Unleavened Bread.